From the onset of entering the promised land, the people of God struggled.
In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes.
So God raised up judges to help his people stay true to the ways of the Lord.
The last judge was Samuel, who judged Israel all the days of his life.
The people cried out, "Give us a king to judge us like all the nations."
The Lord relented and told Samuel, "Give them their king."
The people chose Saul, a man of good appearance and tall stature, but did not have a heart for God.
The Lord rejected Saul and chose an unlikely candidate in David to be king.
The Lord opposes the proud, exalts the humble, and in spite of evil, his master plan continues to unfold.
This is 1 Samuel.
So they say if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. But for my friends on an October night, their statement was, if you can't stand the heat, don't let Ben build a bonfire. You see, in October, I decided to have a few friends over to have this little community get together where we got to all cook together. We all got to hang out together and listen to music and have a lot of fun. And I decided in my mind, I would love to have this bonfire. You know, that the kids could roast marshmallows, and after they roasted marshmallows, we could all sit around the fire and sing Kumbaya and talk about how much we love each other and how much we love Jesus. And I had this beautiful image in my head of what that was supposed to look like. Well, in order for that to happen, you first have to have a bonfire. And so I decide about 30 minutes before people show up, I'm going to start trying to build this thing. And man, if the wood wasn't the wettest wood I've ever had in my entire life, I mean, it was insane. It would start and then it would just be a smoke show. There's no fire coming from it. And so I would put all these kindling in it. I'd put newspaper. I'd put paper towels. And now people are at my house. And we've been trying to start this fire. And I gave up for about an hour so I could hang out with some friends. And about an hour later, I was like, I'm going to give this another shot. And so I tried to start build it again and get it to where it's supposed to be. And I was like, you know, it's not working. So I was like, kids, everyone get away. I'm going to give it a little bit of encouragement. And so I go into my shed and I get the diesel can. And diesel, if you don't know, doesn't burn as intensely and as quickly and doesn't have as much of an explosive nature as gasoline does. And so I pour a little bit of diesel on the fire to see if there's any embers, and there's not. And I pour it to the left of the fire, there's nothing. And I kind of do one of those, nothing. I was like, okay, good, there's no flame, I'm just going to douse this thing. And then I would like make a little bit of a trail, light the trail, and then kumbaya time is about to happen. And so I'm over the fire, really confident that there's no flame. And then I realize at that moment that I messed up. I also realized I was not pouring diesel on it. I was pouring gasoline on the fire. And the only way I could describe what happened next is very similar to probably how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego felt in the fiery furnace. All I saw was white and orange around me. And for the people that were at my house, they all thought I died. And it's one of those, I don't know if you've ever had like a really serious injury where like it hurts, but then like 3 or 4 seconds later, it like really hurts. And so I was in shock. I'm holding 4 extra gallons of gasoline in my hand and I'm walking away from the fire like this. I mean, it's so slow because I'm like, I'm about to feel third degree burns all over my body. But weirdly enough, I don't feel any burns. Somehow I didn't get burned. And then I look around and nobody's in my backyard anymore. Like, kids left. My friend said that his little girl was like, why did we leave, Daddy? And he goes, well, Uncle Ben set himself on fire, so we had to leave. I'm like, it's not that big of a deal. I didn't get burned. And then I hear, Ben, the gas can is on fire. And I look at the gas can that I'm holding in my hand still, and fire is pouring out of the nozzle. So I run and I get the sprinkler and I douse the flame, and somehow, some way, no one died. Everything was great. The fire ended up going eventually because I think with that much gasoline, it was like, okay, fine, I'll catch on fire. And we ended up having a good rest of the night. But I will tell you, that was in October. I have not had a bonfire at my house since. And the reason is because it affected me. If I'm honest with you, and this is like a real thing, I mean, I had like PTSD over that for a few weeks. I mean, I remember just praying to the Lord, like, God, like, thank you for not allowing me to die. And I would start, and even talking about it now, I get nervous. Like, I don't want to ever have to do that again, because none of us like to be in the fire. But man, if sometimes God doesn't have us in the fire for a reason. And a lot, and what we're going to see today is that when God gets us in the fire, when God gets us in that, it's not to kill us, it's not to scare us, but a lot of times it's a refining fire. And what happens is it's painful and we want to run away, we don't want to be a part of it, but that's when those imperfections get to be brought out. And it's not fun and it's never something that we sign up for, but a lot of times it's exactly where God wants us to be. And what we're going to see in the story of First Samuel this morning is David is in the middle of the refining fire. And what we're going to see is that David has multiple opportunities to get himself out of that fire, but he chooses not to. And because he chooses not to, and because he chooses to be faithful while he's in the fire, what we're going to see is that David has a life-changing moment that happens when he's in the middle of the refining fire. And so to catch us up to where we are right now, we're going to be in 1 Samuel 24 through 26. And as we ended last week, what happened is Saul is about to catch up to David finally and kill him. And then a messenger comes to Saul and says, the Philistines are attacking Israel. So Saul had to leave. And that catches us up to where we are right here in 1 Samuel 24. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goat's rocks. And he came to the sheep's fold by the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost part of the cave. I want to talk about that for 1 second. The word for relieve, it's really funny when you look at commentaries and what people think these translations are. A lot of times it's like, well, David went to go to the bathroom in the cave. But in reality, David is not going to the bathroom, because the Hebrew word for relieve is to cover, to surround, to kind of put a hedge of protection around. And so what's happening is Saul is in all of these rocks and all of these caves trying to seek out David. He gets tired and he goes inside of the cave so that he can get some rest. Probably what he does is he takes his robe off so he could sleep. And the army was in the front of the cave to protect him from anything that would come in. But what's funny and what's ironic is David and the men that they're looking for are in the innermost part of the cave. And so verse 4, and the men of David said to him, here is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. Then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. So what happened is Saul is there. The men are like, finally, this is the guy that's causing us to be on the run. This guy has tried to kill you, David, for the last however many years. This is your chance to stop all of that right now. And David's like, all right, let's do it. And he like stealthily, I'm just seeing him kind of like doing one of these things. And he like gets and he cuts off a piece of Saul's robe. And then it says that his heart struck him, meaning like his heart failed him. He was upset. And it doesn't make a lot of sense when we read it inside of our own culture, because if you remember, the Bible was not written to us. This was not written for the 21st century American church. It's for us, but it's not to us. And so for us to understand, in our culture, that doesn't make sense, but we don't wear the same things and live in the same culture back in that day. Because back in that day, what David did was actually very important, because the clothes that you would wear was very important back in that day. And what that showed is the clothes you would wear would show where you were in that society, how much power you had, the kind of family that you had. And there's two main things that's important for us to know to understand why David's heart struck him. The first thing, the hem of these robes, the very bottom of those robes. Every family had a different hem. And so a lot of people thought that the authority and the societal status, and most importantly, the power of a person was found in the hem of their robe. Which is why, if you look in the New Testament, when the woman with the bloody discharge was saying that she wanted to be healed, she said, I will be healed if I touch the what? The hem of his garment. Because the power of the person was in the hem. And so when David would have cut off the corner of that robe, part of the hem would have been cut off. But there's one more important thing for us to know. At the corner of every person's robe back in this day was a tassel. And we see this in Numbers chapter 15. It says, the Lord said to Moses, speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of blue on the tassel of each corner. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, to do them, not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. And so what was important about these tassels, especially back in that culture, is outside of Israel, the only people that would wear tassels were kings. The more tassels they had, the more noble, the more royal that they were. But God wanted his whole nation to be reminded that they are royalty, that they have noble blood in them because they are God's people. He also told them to put a cord of blue on the edge of each, in each tassel, which the color blue was the color of the priest. And so what the Lord was telling his people is you need to be reminded of your identities. You need to be reminded that you are noble, that you are royal, that you are a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. You are my people. And so when David cut off the corner of this robe, this wasn't just a little thing like cutting off a little part of our shirt. This was David taking the place of God. This was David assigning identity to Saul. What David was basically saying is he was saying, you're not worthy to be a king. You're not worthy to be God's person. You're not worthy to be a priest within these kingdom of priests. And so this wasn't a little thing. This was David taking the place of God. Jacob Milgram says this about these tassels. The word tassel in Hebrew is tzitzit. And it says, the tzitzit is the epitome of the democratic thrust within Judaism, which equalizes level playing field, not by leveling, but by elevating. All of Israel is enjoined to become a nation of priests. In antiquity, the tzitzit and the hem of the garment was the insignia of authority, high breeding, and nobility. By adding the blue woolen cord to the tzitzit, the Torah combined nobility with priesthood. Israel is not to rule man, but to serve God. Furthermore, tzitzit is not restricted to Israel's leaders, be they kings, rabbis, or scholars. It is the uniform of all Israel. So what David did is he took the place of God. What David did is he assigned identity. But no matter who we are, we don't dictate people's identities, including our own. Man, that title belongs to God. And at the end of the day, God gave Saul his identity as a king. And so the only person who could remove that identity rightly was God. And so David failed here, which is why when he did it, his heart failed him. His heart struck him. And so we know that Saul ends up leaving the cave. In verse 8, it continues. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My lord the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed his face with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks your harm'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, the corner of your robe in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you." And so Saul ends up hearing this and replying to what David said in verse 17. And he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, and that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day." And here is a very key verse in all of 1 Samuel. This is very important for us to see here in verse 20. Saul says, "And now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." So what's happening here is Saul is asking David to have a covenant with him to not cut off his family once David becomes king, which is very similar to the covenant that David made with Jonathan just a few chapters ago. Very key. David swore this to Saul. Then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. And so we think this is the end. And the chase is over. Years of running away, years of Saul trying to kill David, it's all got to be done. But a little bit of a spoiler, we're going to see this in about 10 minutes. That doesn't happen. Saul goes right back to chasing after David and trying to kill him. But what we're about to see here is we're about to see a really big story in chapter 25. And what we're going to see is this story breaks the drama between Saul and David. And what this story is it's not random at all why it's in there. In fact, what this story is this is a turning point in the life of David. This is the life-changing moment that happens in his life when he's in the middle of this refining fire. And so what we're going to see is David's heart start being changed. And so this is what happens. Chapter 25. "Then David rose and went to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal." It says a B in it, but it's pronounced Nabal. "And the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite." And so we see there that it talks about 3,000 sheep. Again, everything in Jewish literature is 100% in there for a reason. If you remember, how many men did David bring to kill David in chapter 24? Does anybody remember? 3,000. And so what this is doing, the author is comparing Nabal to Saul. The names also sound the same. Also important to know, the word Nabal in Hebrew literally means fool. I mean, thanks, Mom and Dad, for naming me Nabal. And so he's comparing it. And so David finds out that this man is wealthy, that he's about to have this feast. And so he sends his servants to go see Nabal and say, "Can you feed us? And, you know, we've been protecting your shepherds. We've been protecting your sheep as if they're our own." And David's men go to Nabal to get him to see if they can do this. And David's young men came, verse 9, "They said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to men who come from where I do not know?' So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this." So what happens, it's not that Nabal doesn't know David. Nabal is mocking David. He knows David, and what we see here is that Nabal is a staunch supporter of King Saul, and he sees David as merely a rebel that's running away from his master. And as we see in verse 13, that doesn't make David very happy. "And David said to his men, 'Every man strap on his sword.' And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David while 200 remained with the baggage." And so David is about to go crazy mode on Nabal. We don't know exactly what's going to happen yet, and the servants of Nabal end up finding out about this. And so they go to Abigail, who's Nabal's wife, and they're like, "Our master is worthless. He's a fool. Like, David did nothing wrong. He completely disrespected him. And now David's about to go crazy on us. We didn't do anything wrong." And so if you remember, Abigail is wise. She's discerning. And so she's like, "Hey, I'm going to get together this gift basket. and I'm going to give it to David, and then I'll go meet David myself. And so Abigail goes to find David. And David says this in the middle of all of it. He says, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. God, do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him." David's not happy. And I just like to put myself in stories sometimes. Because I think we read the Bible and we're like, and then 14,700 people died. Not thinking about like, what would it have been like if we were there? Put yourself being somebody who has followed David in the midst of all of this. All right, you're in the cave and there's the man right in front of you sleeping, unguarded. And you're like, "David, this is your chance, man. Like, you kill him, all of this ends." And David's like, "Okay." And he like tiptoes. And then he cuts off a piece of his garment and he gets like all sensitive and hurt about it. And you're like, "Wow, okay, like, I guess David's gotten soft." And then you see Nabal and he like disrespects you a little bit. And David's like, "Strap on your swords. We're going mass genocide mode." And you're like, "David, man, like, what is happening here? Like, he went insane." But I think at the end of the day, we can find ourselves in this story way more often than we'd like to admit. Because what David is trying to do here is David's trying to avenge himself. He's been disrespected. And how many of us do that? How many times do I do that? Like, maybe I don't go all mass genocide mode and I'm like, "Strap on your swords, I'm killing their whole family." But I also know that my Jesus said when he was on earth, he said that you have heard it say, "Do not murder." But I say to you that if you have hate in your heart for your brother, you have committed murder in your heart for him. And man, we may not actually physically try to murder people, but I will tell you, this week and this week alone, I have murdered a lot of people in my heart. And I'm not proud of that. I'm not happy with that, but I read this story about David and what he's doing and the thoughts that he's having, and I'm like, man, I may not be actually wanting to kill people, but I have killed people in my heart this week. And so we can't read this story and go, "Wow, David, you went crazy," because when I read this story, I went, "Man, that's me." Actually, I'm in my office, and I'm like, "Man, that's me right now." Because David wanted to avenge himself. He wanted the final word. And so he's about to commit this mass genocide, and then Abigail gets a chance to talk to him. And when Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young man of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant." So David responds, and David says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male." And so David hears Abigail. And he's like, "You know what? You're right. Like, that's not something that I should do. Thank you for keeping me from doing something that I really didn't want to do." And then here's the key. This is what happens that's so big in the story. And here's the life change that happens within the life of David. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. And so what we see here is that Abigail atoned for the sin of her husband. She went in front of David, got on her knees, and said, "Treat me like I was the one that did this to you. Don't kill all of these people. Kill me instead." What David saw was David saw humility, and humility changed David's heart. Because David killing Nabal and his people would have been sin. The blood guilt would have been on him and his men. And what David did is that David got in the driver's seat and said, "I'm going to be the one that's going to avenge myself." And what we see is David did not learn from what he learned in chapter 24 with Saul. Again, David is trying to take the place of God. David in chapter 24 was changing people's identity. David in chapter 25 was the one that was creating the avenging and the vengeance. David isn't learning from these lessons, but in this moment right here, David saw humility and it changed him. Like even the most famous human in the history of all of the world, arguably, we see had a hard time with sin, had a hard time waiting on the Lord. But I will tell you, that did not make David, that didn't change his identity as a man after God's own heart. But what we see is there is something here that does define David as someone after God's own heart, after God's own will, after God's own choosing. It's the fact that he was coachable. It's the fact that he was able to change his mind. You see, David was hell-bent on the fact that he was going to commit the vengeance. He was going to avenge the person who disrespected him. But then one person came and showed him humility, and David changed his mind. And because David changed his mind, a group of people that were innocent were saved. David and his men were saved from doing unspeakable sins. But also what happened is that David was able to watch God avenge him himself. God was able to fight David's battles. God was able to be the one to show him, like, "David, you are not me. Let me be me and you be you." And this changes David, because what we're about to see in 1 Samuel chapter 26 is that David has another opportunity to kill Saul. But what we're going to see is because of this humility and this life change that happens right here with Nabal, what we're going to see is that David has a different heart when he goes there. And so as we know, Saul is a giant liar and goes back to trying to chase after David in 26. So that narrative picks up. And so Saul and his men end up encamping, and then it catches up here in verse 6. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite, to Joab's brother Abishai the son of Zeruiah, who will go down with me into the camp of Saul? And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai went to the army by night. And there lay Saul sleeping with the encampment, with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now," I love this, "now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who could put his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And David said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into the battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But now take the spear that is at his head and the jar of water and let us go." So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. And so the way David reacts to this situation is very different, because the way that David reacted to the situation and the way that David actually viewed Saul was different. I mean, just look at what verse 10 says. And David said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish." And so what we're seeing here is that David is saying, hey, like, Saul's not my responsibility. Like, if God wants to strike Saul right now and make me king, that's exactly what he's going to do. Or Saul's going to die by natural causes. Or Saul's going to die when he's in battle. Like, that's not my responsibility. And what we're seeing here, the change of perspective for David, is that David now in chapter 26 is like, I'm just going to control what I can control. Saul is not my responsibility. I'm going to let God deal with Saul, and I'm going to do what God has called me to do. Because if the Lord wants something to succeed, no matter what we do, it's gonna succeed. If the Lord wants something to fail and fall flat on its face, then there is nothing we can do to keep that from happening. And that's what David learns here. Like, and what David did in chapter 24 is that he let opposition distract him from his mission. But that's not something we can do. We can't let opposition distract us from our mission and distract us and to remove the motivation that we have. We have to be focused on what we're doing right now and what God is leading us to do right now. And we can't be focused on other people that are not our responsibility and people that we cannot control. And I'll tell you guys, my prayer every week is that the message that I preach up here on stage, that the first audience member of this message would be me. I don't ever want to preach something because it's like, oh, look how much I know. I want it to come from a place of, this is what God has taught me this week. And there are some times that messages come that the Lord gives me something that I really, really, really needed. But I will tell you, the messages I need the most are also the messages I want the least. And I'll be honest with you, this message was like, are you kidding me, God? I don't want to preach on this. Can I do something else? Can I do a one-off? But the Lord was just like, dude, like, I need you to learn something. Like, look at David's life. Like, we're 10 chapters now, years removed from David being anointed king of Israel. Years. And since he's been anointed king of Israel, he has been attempted to be murdered 12 times within the palace. And for the last few years, he has been on the run from the person that he's supposed to replace as king. And now he's given two perfect opportunities to end all of this. David had an opportunity to fast forward his suffering. He had an opportunity to fast forward himself to be king. And if David would have just slit his throat, or if David would have killed him and put a spear through his heart, he could be king. Like, he no longer had to sleep in caves and be far away from his family. He no longer had every corner that he turned be afraid of who's going to be there. David could have ended all of this, but he didn't do it. Why? Well, it's because the Lord didn't have that in store for David. Because that would have been the easiest route. Those two opportunities that he had to kill Saul, all of his suffering would have gone away. But at the end of the day, in the life and the journey that we walk, very rarely is the easy route the route that God wants us to take. And very rarely do we ever grow when everything is easy. Because in fact, what the Lord wanted from David is, he goes, David, yes, I want you to be king one day. Yes, you're going to lead my people. What we see in 2 Samuel is, for the first time ever, the tribes of Israel will be united under the reign of David. But God said, not right now. Right now, I want you to be in the refining fire. I want you, and that's what this refining fire does, is it's like a piece of gold. And it has these imperfections and impurities all throughout it. And the only way to get those impurities out is to bring it inside of a furnace and heat it up to a really hot temperature. And the gold morphs and the gold changes. But what happens is, after a while, those impurities rise to the surface. You then take that gold out and you skim off the imperfections. You put it away. Then you put that piece of gold back in the furnace. And you keep going back and forth, skimming off the imperfections, putting it back in. And I will tell you, the thing about the refining fire and the thing about the furnace is that it's really hot, it's not fun, it's painful, and it makes us all want to run away, because that's not something we want to be a part of. And I will be honest with you guys this week, I want to be honest up here on the stage, there was two times this week that I legitimately was like, God, I want to run. And I'll be, I am not a runner. If anybody knows, when I'm in conflict, I'm a fighter. I'm like, you want to punch me in the face? I'll punch you in the face right back, bro. But today, I will tell you that this week, I wanted to run in the other direction. I was like, God, I don't want to be here. God, I want to go in another direction. God, I want to go to another church. Let me live in another city, because all of this would be so much easier. And the Lord told me, when I'm sitting in my recliner complaining about everything, he said, but Ben, where's the blessing in running? But Ben, where's the life change in running? And he goes, I have a sermon for you, actually. You can preach this one. And what we see is that David had an opportunity to speed that refining process up. He had an opportunity to get himself out of the fire, but he chose not to. And what we see is, especially that second time, is that David's life was changed after seeing Abigail's faithfulness. Let's take it home. Worship team, come up. Like, he saw the image of the pre-incarnate Christ. He saw what humility looked like, and what that led was that led to life change, to remind him that he's not responsible for Saul. He's not in control of what he does or what he doesn't do. David let God deal with Saul, and David just controlled what God put in front of him so that he could be responsible for what God had for him in that moment. Saul was not a part of that. And I'll be honest, isn't it crazy? Isn't it awesome, in not a good way, how human nature every single time is, it's so much easier for us to look on the outside and to look at other people and to look at other organizations and to look at other churches and to complain and grumble about what they're doing and what they're supposed to be doing and not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But a lot of times what that does is it's really easy for us to do that because it takes us away from looking at the mirror ourselves. And this is what the Lord showed me this week. Is he goes, Ben, outside things aren't what I'm calling you to. I'm not calling you to look at what Doug is doing. I'm not calling you to look at what Highway Church of Christ or Kinsett First Baptist or Connect City is doing. That's not you. That's not your responsibility. Your responsibility is what I have for you at Fellowship Bible Church right now. Your responsibility is to look at the personal life that you have right now. Don't worry about that. Let me deal with that. And if it's going to be successful, then guess what? There is nothing that you're going to do that's ever going to keep that from being successful. And if it's not going to be successful, there's also nothing that you're going to do to make that not from being successful. Ben, it's not. Don't worry about that. Worry about this. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to stop worrying about all these outside things. And we have to start focusing on what's going on here, asking ourselves the hard questions of what's going on here, asking ourselves, are we a people that is changing the community around us because we're preaching the gospel everywhere we go? Does everyone in our workplaces, because we're there, know the gospel because we're bold in sharing the gospel with every person that comes in? Are we being people that are discipling and being discipled? And I will tell you guys, that is not just something that we do when we have time. That is an implicit command of the Lord that we are supposed to do. And if we are not discipling other people and being discipled by other people, we are living outside of the will of God and we are being disobedient to his commandments. Are we discipling and are we being discipled? We have to ask ourselves, are we looking at the widows and the orphans and taking care of them as pure and undefiled religion is supposed to be? Are we discipling the next generation of children and students in our church who are one day going to be the future leaders of this place? Are we not neglecting the poor and taking care of them? Are we taking the gospel to the nations and to our neighborhoods? Are we taking care of the families that we have that are our number one ministries and our number one priorities? And we have to be asking ourselves that question first, because if we say that we're not doing all of those things, then who cares what's going on the outside? Who cares what Doug is doing? Who cares what's happening at all the other churches, whether they're doing it right or not? We have a responsibility here. And I will tell you, this is not a condemnation. This is not me yelling because I'm angry. This is me yelling because I'm like, let's go. This is me saying, like, let's get it. There's too much at stake. And I'll be honest with you guys, this is not get it figured out, everybody. This is I'm sorry as a leader that I have let you down. I am sorry that I have taken ownership and leadership away from you and I've put it on myself. Like, how dare me? How dare the leaders here? And I'll be honest, we have been lulled asleep by by the devil here in this church. We have gotten comfortable sitting in our seats, and we are not doing what the Lord has called us to do. There have been widows that I know for a fact that have lived in our church for over 4 years that are living underneath the poverty level, and we have done nothing about it. There are 40 spots, and there has been 40 spots for us to disciple the next generation of people, and it's not being filled. Let's stop focusing on what's going on the outside, and let's start focusing on what God has for us here, because it is being neglected because we have been lulled to sleep. I think all of us, just like David, have been placed in the refining fire. And we have two options. First one's easy. We can run. You could say, let's just get back to normal. Let's get comfortable again. But as the Lord told me this week while I'm sitting in my recliner, where's the blessing in that? Or we can take the second option, which is the hardest. And we can say, man, let the refining fire change us. And I've been given gifts by the Lord. Let me use those gifts. I've been given resources, my time, my money, my treasure, all of these things. I'm going to give it to the Lord because that is what the Lord is deserving of. I'm going to serve and not just serve, but disciple the next generation of leaders here in our church. I'm going to start ministries. I'm going to be a part of what God has here because we're excited about what God is about to do here. Because if we allow the refining fire to wake us up, what the refining fire will also do is it will revive us from our sleep. And what we will find is when each and every one of us get on our knees and say, God, what do you have for me? And it doesn't matter how painful it's going to be. I want what you want. What's going to happen is we're going to see revival in this place like no one has ever seen before. Because when God's people come awake, get ready, because the devil is about to lose his mind. But if we do it together and we stand arm in arm, the devil won't be able to stand against what we got going on here. So we can run, can hold the gas can like this. Or we can stand over the fire and we can say, Lord, whatever you want. It's painful and it's not fun, but it's where life change awaits. We're at a state right now where it's all hands on deck. I was telling that to one of our elders 2 days ago. Like, in order for this to work, we have to have every single person that calls this church home to say, I want to serve, I want to pour, I want to disciple, I want to be a part of the life change that's about to happen here at Fellowship. And it's all hands on deck, but I will tell you, it has always been all hands on deck. And at the end of the day, we've been, as an elder told me yesterday, I called him and he said, Ben, I feel like we've been on a cruise ship for the last few years, and cruises are fun. But on cruises, you can lay back and let other people serve you. But man, we're not on a cruise ship. The cruise ship is... We got to flip that back over and we got to make it a battleship. It's time to fight because it is a battleship, because it is a battle, because we are facing a war. If we knew what was even happening in this room right now with demons and angels that are fighting for our attention and fighting for our hearts, I think we would get off the cruise ship and we'd put on our armor. It's a battleship. Every man, every woman at his stations, and let's fight. Because that's what we've been called to do. To put on the whole armor of God so that we may be able to stand against the attacks of the enemy. Let's fight. Let's get to our stations and let's go to war for the kingdom of God. One of the ways you can do that is by praying. Sorry, elders, if you don't want me to say this. We're going to be here at 3:30 as some people to pray before. If you guys would like to come and pray with us, just for our church and for the meeting at 4, and also, we need you at the meeting. Let's talk. Let's pray. Let's get to business. We have communion up here on both sides. We're sorry the last 3 weeks we've gone late, but we have communion on both sides so that we can remind ourselves why we get to go to war. So we're going to keep it reverent in here. If you want to visit, please go out in the lobby. It's huge. It's fun. It's exciting to do that out there. And then we also are going to have every one of our elders that are here and their wives. They don't know this yet, but they're doing it. They're going to be here, and we're going to be able to pray with you and love on you and get you equipped for the war. We'll see you guys at 4 o'clock. You know what to do now? Go love first. We love because he first loved us. Have a great week of worship fellowship.